Facebook, Google, all of these companies are trying to figure out where are the rules and where are they going to draw the line.
There's clearly a demand for renters. They've got most of them full.
If you own a bond in your retirement portfolio, the price of that is going to go down.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And welcome to Thursday afternoon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch. We'll talk to Dennis Rodkin about real estate. He's got a great piece in Crain's this week about the, you know, Mayor Emanuel. One of the things he really worked on doing is was bringing big corporations out of the suburbs and back into the city center. And what they've done then, of course, is leave not only some holes when it comes to employment in the suburbs, it's really had an impact on the real estate market, on the high-end real estate market. So we will talk to Dennis about that a little bit later in the program. I was saying earlier that the FCC, the Federal Communications, voted today to allow phone providers to block illegal and unwanted calls before they ever get to us. So they can actually, if they identify these as an illegal robocall, they can block it before your phone rings. Roger Chang is an editor at CNET.com, and he joins us on the phone line now. Roger, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks for having me.
This could be one of the most popular things the FCC has ever done. Tell me.
Yeah, the FCC is no stranger to controversy, but helping to stamp out robocalls is something I think we can all agree is something that's really, really been long-awaited and long overdue. The FCC has voted to basically empower carriers to more actively block these robocalls. Prior to this, carriers had really only had the power to flag and warn customers that this may be a robocall, but you still get them. And so, you know, actually proactively blocking some of these calls, and it's massive. We saw the volume just last month, those 2 billion robocalls.
Wow.
So being able to block some of these proactively so that you actually don't even get them is a huge step in the right direction.
And so how do they detect which is a robocall and which is an illegal robocall and which isn't?
So they have been, and I think that's going to be kind of the issue and how it might get a little bit shaky at first. But, you know, they've been working on systems that, cooperate between carriers that kind of learn or are smart enough to recognize what is a robocall. But there are concerns that some actual legitimate robocalls might actually get blocked, in the rush to stamp out, all the terrible ones. You know, there are medical updates. There are legitimate robocalls that do come through that you may actually need to listen to. And so the concern there is some of those might get blocked as well.
Well, you know what? That's a really good point, because when you said legitimate robocalls, I was thinking of campaign calls from Mitch McConnell or Barack Obama, and I don't want those either. But when I get a call from when I get a call from my drugstore saying my prescription's ready, that essentially is a robocall too, and that's the sort of thing that you don't want blocked.
Absolutely.
All right, so this goes into effect right away. The phone companies, I think the FCC said they should be able to be up and running with this pretty quickly.
Yes. So this was a FCC vote that just took place this morning. The carriers basically have the authority to go forth and start blocking these robocalls.
Go forth and block. That's good news. Okay. I want you to give us a little primer too on Huawei, the Chinese company, because, the Trump administration acting against it here, putting pressure on European countries to act against it there. And yet I see now they just signed a big deal to help develop 5G in Russia. So why is it that we should be concerned about this company, Huawei?
Well, Huawei has had this reputation for having extremely close ties with the Chinese government. Its chairman, its founder was a former Chinese military, was part of the Chinese military. And so there's always been a suspicion that, Huawei gear, telecom equipment, could theoretically have some sort of backdoor that would allow China to snoop into our systems. That's why the U.S. has for a long time banned the use of Huawei equipment here in our networks. The heads of the FBI, the CIA, the NSA have all basically recommended that you not buy a Huawei phone, despite the fact that it is the second most popular smartphone maker in the world right now.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, so how would I come upon a Huawei phone?
In the U.S., you really have to go out of your way to buy one.
Okay.
It's whether you buy it online on Amazon or through some other third-party retailer. you couldn't get it through an AT&T or Verizon. The U.S. carriers don't stock them. The phones are, for all the controversy, you know, CNET rates those phones fairly highly, and they are pretty popular around the world. And there's, as far as I can tell, there's a lot less concern about the phones themselves. It's really, a lot of the concern has been centered on the telecom equipment, such as sort of the back-end system that, you know, feeds into our critical infrastructure. It's why we've sort of shut Huawei out, and, you know, a couple of other countries, largely U.S. allies, have started to do the same as well.
Well, it strikes me as odd then, because Russia certainly knows from spying, and if we're worried about what Huawei might be doing for China, why wouldn't Russia be?
You know, look, that's the thing about what's going on around the world, is there are still countries out there that have expressed their support for Huawei. So, you know, it's not, for all the concerns and all the suspicions that we've had, we've never actually seen any, you know, publicly available evidence. So we don't really know in the end. So, you know, some countries have decided to roll the dice, and some countries have decided to trust Huawei. But the U.S. has clearly made its stance very very apparent.
Will our stance against them have any impact in our development of the 5G?
That is, I think the position the U.S. has taken hasn't been influenced a lot by the development of 5G. Huawei is definitely at the forefront, you know, alongside some of these other equipment makers. But, you know, Huawei and China have put a lot of resources into developing 5G and trying to make themselves into a leader in 5G. You know, the U.S. is up there as well, and I think I don't think it's a coincidence that the ban and the aggressiveness of these bans are coming at a time when 5G is just coming to light.
You know, I want to move on to another topic. It was striking to me that President Trump was overseas talking about people boycotting AT&T because he didn't like CNN's news, and he talks about it as fake news. Okay, so there's that, which is not a typical response, I would say, or maybe inappropriate response. But he's saying that just last week he was retweeting fake news, clearly fake news, this video of not Nancy Pelosi, a doctored video. While he's decrying fake news, he is perpetuating it. And you guys have a piece up on CNET that video has kind of disappeared. What happened?
Yeah, this was a CNET scoop from a couple of days ago. The video was pulled down. The wrinkle of it all is that no one really knows, or no one knows for sure who took it down. Facebook says it didn't do it. Politics Watchdog, the group that posted the video, says it didn't remove the video. So there's sort of a he said, she said situation here. But clearly that was a lightning rod for controversy. It was clearly a doctored photo. Well, I guess it wasn't that clear, but it was a doctored video. It definitely misrepresented Nancy Pelosi. It's become a mystery, sort of who actually took the video down. Was this a publicity stunt? We really don't know.
Right, because they're blaming Facebook, and of course Facebook's under fire from conservatives for quieting conservative voices, so it sort of works for them. Facebook says we didn't do it.
Absolutely.
Hey,
we got
30 seconds left. I went down to my basement yesterday and saw my son and two of his buddies all on a couch playing on a game on their Xbox machine, and there was a particular aroma there. I didn't realize it was a new cologne.
Yes, this is one of the more ridiculous bits of news in tech today. Yeah, Microsoft has partnered with Axe to create a line of Xbox-related deodorant, bug spray, because that's what you think when you think gamers. Really good-smelling people.
So the idea is that it's going to be either a novelty gift or boys who love the game are going to buy the deodorant. We'll see about that.
I mean, if you're spending, you know, 18 hours a day gaming nonstop, you probably could use a little bit of deodorant.
Right. And if this encourages you to pick it up, hey, that's all the better.
There you go.
Roger Chang from CNET. Thanks very much for stopping by, Roger.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank. It was a couple of weeks ago we were talking about this Chicago area company called Prestige Exotics, and the idea is that they just take really super expensive cars and put them in the hands of amateurs like you and me. And the guy who came up with the idea is Ehab Odeh. He's the CEO of Prestige Exotics, and he joins us on a phone line now. Ehab, what were you thinking?
Honestly, I don't know if I was thinking great, but I mean, I have a passion for cars, and it's a void in the Chicago market. Thought of filling it, and like you said, I just wanted to put the supercar, the luxury car, in the hands of the average consumer, and you know, have them experience their dream car ride.
Listen, okay, listen, I'm not a car guy at all. I sometimes forget the make and model of my own car, and like right now, it's a Ford. It's an Escape. I have a Ford Escape, I'm pretty sure. I'm not kidding you. I do forget.
Nice car.
Yeah, well, but I'm reading about your company, and I don't even recognize the names of these cars that you have available for rent. Tell me about them.
Yeah, these aren't your average everyday cars. They're not your Hondas or Toyotas or Fords or Chevys. These are the premier supercars, sport cars, and luxury cars of the world. I mean, they're exclusive, of course, due to the nature of the price. And they're honestly not everyday vehicles.
Right.
They're vehicles that can be enjoyed for different occasions, anniversaries, proms, weddings, and even just your average car enthusiast.
No, would you let an 18-year-old high school senior rent one of these cars?
No, of course, per our insurance policy, you have to be 25 years of age,
okay,
or older,
okay,
and you have to have a clean driving record, of course.
So who does rent these cars?
Mostly, we have two groups of clientele. We have the prom and wedding type of service, which is mostly chauffeured, and the other group of clients that we have are, like I said, the enthusiasts. Mainly, you know, I'm working 30-year-old plus people who enjoy cars,
right,
and just like to, you know, have the thrill of the experience.
You know, we were talking earlier on the show earlier this week about fine watches, $100,000 watches, and you can't really enjoy a $100,000 watch without buying it, I guess, or maybe you could rent it, but you can enjoy a car like this by renting it for
exactly
a day. I'm thinking like a Father's Day or something like that.
Exactly, exactly. And we do have a Father's Day special going on now. And like you said, I mean, it's something new. It's something, just, you know, we're trying to put out there. Not everyone, I mean, even if you have the money to buy a $300,000 car, it's not practical. So you can't
no
enjoy it for a day or two or a week.
Right, even if you have $300,000 to buy a car, don't do it.
Exactly. It's not practical.
So how's business been? How long have you been up and running?
This is our third official month.
Okay.
So it is the start of the summer season. Business is booming due to the season. Our prom season was amazing. We have a lot of wedding pre-books, and we'll see how fall and winter goes. We do have luxury SUVs for the winter, so we'll see how it goes. I mean, we're loving it so far.
Oh, that's good. And how many cars do you have for rent?
30 car fleet right now.
What is the most expensive car you have for rent, and what does it cost?
Sure. We have two cars. They're about $600,000 each. We have the Lamborghini Aventador Roadster, and then we have the Rolls-Royce Phantom, which is Rolls-Royce's premier vehicle.
And how much do they cost to rent a day?
Those are $2,000 a day each.
Okay, wow. And so, yeah, so I'm happily married, but I was joking when we were talking about your business a few weeks ago that this would be perfect to drive to your ex-wife's wedding or something like that.
If you'd like to make a statement, yes.
And you mentioned earlier about insurance. I would imagine you pay. Well, is it your responsibility to insure these cars, or is it the renters, or how does that work?
Well, unlike your average rent-a-car through Enterprise or Hertz, the customer has to have a full coverage policy of their own, of course,
uh-huh,
making them insurable. And we also have a layer of insurance, and that's a must only because of the value of the cars.
Sure. Okay. All right. So look down the road here, no pun intended, to a year, maybe 5 years from now. Where do you expect to be?
Honestly, the sky's the limit, especially in Chicago. Chicago is I mean, you know, it's the second city. It's amazing. I mean, the potential is huge. I mean, only down part of Chicago is our few months of winter.
Right.
But other than that, I mean, we're expecting to be a 100-car fleet within a couple of years.
Ihab O'Day is the CEO of Prestige Exotics, a really super fancy cars available for $400 to $2,000 a day. Where do people find more information about you, Ihab?
Our website, prestigeexotics.com, and they're more than welcome to stop by our showroom in Burridge.
All right, listen, it was great to talk to you. I wish you great success.
Likewise.
Thank you very much, David Jennings. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Dennis Rodkin is in the studio. Rahm Emanuel is out of office. Those are my two location points for the story. Oops, I didn't have you on.
If you're nominating me for mayor, I'm not ready.
So one of my things, and he did this very well, I'm a suburbanite. Emmanuel was very good at taking businesses that probably had once been downtown businesses, moved to the suburbs, and he brought them back, right?
Well, I think you might be giving him too much agency.
Well, he certainly worked to do it. He worked to bring the headquarters back downtown. My beloved Bulls, who used to be my neighbors,
right?
You know, they now are down here. You wrote a great story in Cranes about what that has meant for the housing market, because as all of these big executives used to live further and further out, you know, we used to decry the fact that the cornfields were being paved. They were paved paradise and put up a McMansion.
A McMansion, yeah.
But now these McMansions are going for what? What's going on?
Well, so one of the things I was looking at is there were two trends going on in the 90s, building big houses in the suburbs and moving jobs to the suburbs. And those did coincide in a very clear way. If you built, I mean, to me, the great example is Sears, when it left the West Loop and moved to Hoffman Estates, was taking thousands of people out there, out to Prairie Stone, but at the same time was developing this big office park that was going to have, you know, vendor companies and friends and family and all that all packed around them. So what you thought if you were out there building a house is there are going to be all these people employed out here. Prairie Stone, which is what Sears built, was going to have as many as 20,000 employees in the early 90s when it was all announced. That was the plan, was to build up to. So that's 20,000 jobs based pretty far outside downtown.
Very far outside.
Yeah, so then if I build farther out, I can continue farther out northwest, I'm likely to have a market. However, employment at Prairie Stone is, according to the village, approximately 7,000 people, not 20,000.
You write that in the 1990s, almost 200,000 jobs were created along the Northwest Tollway.
Yeah.
Northwest Highway.
Yeah. Now called the Jane Addams Tollway, but at the time, they were really moving out northwest. There were also jobs moving out the west, out to the western suburbs, but this was a boom, and it, of course, it seemed as if it would continue forever because nobody could foresee that we'd all end up coming back into the city, that retirees and college students and everybody in between would prefer to live in the city after all. But at the time, it looked like if I build a 10,000 square foot house, I don't build the house to sell it, I build the house to live in it. But my assumption is there will be somebody I can hand it off to later. And what a lot of these sellers are finding out is there's not. There simply isn't.
You've talked a lot about how the high-end market has been pretty slow around here. Is this what this is about?
Well, so these aren't only very high-end houses. These are big. You know, when you get pretty far out, you get out past the Barringtons, that sort of thing. I mean, we might be talking about a $750,000 house.
Okay.
We're talking, in a lot of ways, more, which, of course, is expensive to some people, but is not in the million, two million,
sure,
three million
right.
range we often discuss. But the it's more the big house, the 5-10,000 square foot house. They're not all McMansions. McMansion is a category that people like to use, but they were, you know, big suburban homes with big lawns. And what one real estate agent said to me is, it used to be Barrington, of course, had been rural, right? And then it becomes this place where I'm going to move out there and have my big riding mower and maybe have a tennis court and have all this lawn and be sort of the champion of my manor. And now very few people want that, in part because that was a time when very often the couple had only one working member, one person who worked downtown. The other could be at home getting the kids to the soccer field or whatever it is. Now we both work. And we also are more urban in our appetites for restaurants and everything else.
I was going to say, so we've got the jobs coming downtown, but those people, too, are coming downtown because they just want to live in this downtown city. And that speaks to the apartments and all of that.
So it becomes very hard for me to sell that house just because it's just, you know, it's a question of supply and demand. I created some supply, and now there's not as much demand.
Does that explain why condos are now going for $6 million a piece in Chicago?
yes, good segue, Steve. When you look at the high-end market downtown, it really is happening. Two condos sold for at least $6 million in the course of a week.
Now, one of them is Bennett Place, right? Which is, if we could see through the fog here.
Yeah, one is right across the river from us on the, I think it was the 56th floor of One Bennett Place, a new building designed by Robert A.M. Stern and developed by Related Realty. The other, I'm sorry, Related Midwest. The other is on East Lakeshore Drive, in a Benjamin Marshall building, which are all those classy, wonderful jazz age buildings.
So are these people, these people who might have been living further out back when it was less popular?
In neither case do I know who the buyer is yet. Uh-huh. Their names aren't
I like that, the reporter in you, yet.
I will be watching. If you buy a $6 million condo, I do check back a couple weeks or a month later. At the moment, I don't know who bought them, but generally what I hear from real estate agents is a lot of this is the retired person who used to hang out in the suburbs, and you know, it's quiet out in Lake Forest, Barrington, that sort of thing. Now they want to be down here, they want to go to the restaurants on right. the Gold Coast and things like that. And so I think it's likely that both of these will turn out to be the potential suburban buyers.
Now I had a condo, my first condo in the city was on Orchard, but it was very different from the piece of property you write about that is a little south of there. I was at Orchard and Belden in Lincoln.
Oh, you were a little farther up.
Yeah, right behind Wise Fool's Pub, which was, but anyway.
Which they named for you, right?
I think they did. And so, but there's been these mansions built just a little bit south of there, a little bit south of Armitage, right? And right south of Armitage.
Yeah, the first two blocks south of Armitage on Howe and Burling and Orchard.
You write about this one now that it's vacant property, but the developer had four lots and it just wasn't big enough. So now that he's got a fifth lot, he thinks this mansion is going to be more attractive.
It was the kind of number even I couldn't wrap my head around, and I've been covering these houses for so long. Yeah, on those blocks south of Lincoln Park High School, there have been, really since the 90s, people have been building these multi-lot mansions. The one people tend to know best is the Perillo Mansion, which has been on the market for quite a while now, started at $50 million, now $45 million, looks like a palace. There are a few
others. Is that the one who said is he built it the way his wife wanted and got away from him?
Yeah, exactly. I love that story. He built it because his wife wanted it that way. There are a couple of others that really do look palatial. There's the CEO of Guggenheim Partners is about a block away in another house that looks like a palace. Three lots, four lots, that sort of thing. The Guggenheim one is on five lots. So these developers, BGD&C, had four lots, which a lot in Chicago is 25 by 125. They had four that they were offering at about $18 million. That's for a finished house. And that could accommodate, given zoning, that could accommodate about a 28,000 square foot house.
Who could live in that?
Didn't sell. Exactly. Probably seemed a little tight for some people. So they've now got a deal to buy the fifth lot immediately north, and that would accommodate a 37,000 square foot house.
What will that house go for eventually?
Well, so the starting price is about $25 million, but that's just sort of like for building a shell. As he pointed out, people who are spending that also, I mean, you know, they're
probably going to want a bathroom upstairs, too.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And they're going to have finishes that are really, you know, so it could be, who knows, it could be a $50 million house. No idea. But the idea he had, though, is what we are seeing up there is that people now sometimes build less square footage than is allowed. They may build much smaller because they'd like to have a big yard like they might have in the suburbs.
Dennis Rodkin will be following it. You can follow the building of the house, the purchase and all that at chicagobusiness.com. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Steve.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Have you gotten much golf in this year yet? Well, if so, you might have noticed a few changes to the private courses around the suburban area. Cranes took a deep dive into the growing number of courses that are struggling to keep the money rolling in as memberships decline. Mind you, these are expensive businesses to run, and you can bet that with all the rain and extreme weather we've had in recent past, it's taken a toll on the bottom line as well. However, from a business perspective, these are massive plots of land with only about 100 people on them at any given time. So many of the owners are trying to find a business alternative, most likely the sale of a course. And there's new turnover at the University of Chicago Polsky Center with Jay Schrankler as the new head of entrepreneurship and innovation. His background is in commercializing university research in Minnesota, and it looks like that's what he'll be doing down in Hyde Park. Basically, he'll help take research and projects to the real world and get it into the hands of real people. It will also be an opportunity for the university to make a few bucks. And by a few bucks, I mean hundreds of thousands of dollars. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thank you very much, Orion Samuelson. Steve Bertrand here. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Okay, so there was a story not too long ago in Cranes about DNA tests, and I've had the... Hi, Amy Guth.
Hello.
Amy's here, the host of the Daily Gist, the podcast that you should be subscribing to. I had, I don't remember the company, if it was 23andMe or...
Ancestry or one of those.
DNA plus whatever, but...
Yeah.
So I had my DNA done, or, you know, checked.
Yeah.
And then I bought it for family members and all that. More and more people are doing it. There's a story, though, in Cranes about how, about privacy issues and about how it might be used against us one day.
Yeah, so there is a bill headed for Pritzker's desk that would prevent the at-home DNA testing companies in Illinois from sharing information with any health or life insurance company, because there's a little bit of a loophole. So you can't be denied like health insurance for it, but disability insurance and life insurance, that could impact that. So for example, if you had like, you know, if someone tested for having, say, like a BRCA gene, which is commonly called the breast cancer gene, that could, in theory, legally be permissible for your insurance company to say, you know, I'm not going to insure you for life insurance because you carry the BRCA gene.
I was thinking of long-term healthcare insurance and, you know, that they could use. But then I'm thinking also, Amy, but okay, they factor in all sorts of other things. They factor in my weight. They factor in my family history. So why wouldn't my DNA be fair game for a factor?
Well, there's a couple
As long as it's not, prohibitory, but
that's right.
You know, leads to an increase in cost.
You know, part of that is just because you carry a gene doesn't mean you're definitely going to have that.
Right,
so
right.
It's a bit of a, you know, it's a bit of a gray area still, because that's still such a new area of, you know, of technology. So
if I have a leaky heart valve, I have a leaky heart valve. It's not the same as if I have a gene that might one
that
day
might
lead
one
to...
day do something. Because then there's lifestyle factors, right? Like if you have a gene that predisposes you to something, but you live a really healthy life, it may never come up. But if you don't, it might come up really quickly.
But if I'm running the insurance company, couldn't I say, well, I'm giving you credit for the really healthy life, and then I'm also I'm adding a nickel on for the bad gene.
I mean, I've always said that. I'm like, I should get a discount because I work out all the time I try to eat really healthy and all that. So
I hadn't considered it until I read the article.
It's a really interesting piece, because it's one of those examples we run into a lot where behavior is suddenly out over its skis with the law, and suddenly we realize there's a loophole and we have to catch up with it. That's really, really fascinating. And you know, genetic testing has been around a lot and for a long time in the cancer care area. And so that's been pretty commonplace to start doing genetic testing during cancer treatment. But here in this at-home DNA testing realm, it's opening up a lot of questions. There's also kind of a whole side conversation that people in the fertility industry are infertility industry are having, because now some donors are feeling a little more hesitant, knowing, well, if I donate DNA later, could that person find me? I want to just do this anonymously.
Right.
So it's kind of creating a conversation there. It's a really interesting thing, this ability to test your own DNA. Not to mention that you could just like suddenly have a bunch of siblings you didn't know you had.
Well,
things
I think
like
people
that.
Have found that. That has absolutely happened, I think.
A very good friend of mine has a half-sister she didn't know about.
Wow.
Yeah. And so she's has this whole new branch of the family.
Check
I have
out.
Her permission to talk about it.
What's your name? What's her address?
ChicagoBusiness.com.
What's on the Daily Gist today?
Well, you know what? Today, I too talked with Dennis Rodkin that you were just speaking with. And we were talking about the real estate news of the week, but he has a modest proposal for changing the name of a neighborhood. It's actually a reader's request to change the name of a neighborhood here in Chicago. I think it's funny, and I think it's going to work.
We'll check it out. Check out the Daily Gist, the podcast from Amy Guth, Crane, Chicago Business, and here at WGN Radio. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks so much.